Welcome back to the Babylon Podcast. I am Tim Callender.
I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Joe Carfley.
I'm Neil Einstein.
Hey guys, thanks for joining us. Yes, as you might have noticed, Summer is feeling
I got a frog in my throat.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, she may not be talking too much with us here, but you know, that's how it goes. She's as lovely as ever. So, yes, we are actually summerless. Jeremy's stepping in to be Summer. We'll get things started. And we're going to start it off on a sad note. And I'm not sure. I guess the one we'll talk about first is probably arguably the bigger one. And that is, by now you have all heard of the passing of Neil Armstrong, who died on Saturday the 24th, was it?
25th. He was
25th. Thank you. He was 82 years old, had heart surgery and about 3 weeks prior, and died from complications of that. So I don't know what else can be said that hasn't been said about Neil Armstrong. You know, in a lot of ways, if you want eulogies, there are plenty of better eulogies than what I could give to you. But I can tell you, you know, when I was 6 years old, it was 1969. We were on a big family vacation. We lived in Massachusetts at the time. We were driving to, of all places, Phoenix, Arizona, and off to see family and sightseeing and all the rest. And I remember we were in a Howard Johnson's in Tennessee for the landing and for when Neil first stepped foot on the moon. And I, even at that age, I remember the sensation of the entire world stopping to witness this, you know, and I have not, there's been nothing like it since, nothing at all. I mean, there have been major events and historical events, but nothing on the magnitude of that first lunar landing.
I think Neil Armstrong, a lot of people were saying that he's an American hero, and now in actuality, he's probably Earth's first hero. All those astronauts, even the cosmonauts to some degree, are Earth's first heroes. And you know, the moon landing is such an important moment, not in only in science, but science fiction as well. You know, everything that we got during that time period, Star Trek, you know, and everything was kind of coming out of the space program.
Sure, the whole space race and space age era, if you will. Yeah, I mean, it was a different time. I mean, I think it's easy to say that. But I think you're right. I think these were Earth's heroes, and even though Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and all the moonwalkers planted American flags, I think it was true. They came in peace for all mankind, and you know, Neil saw it. You know, I was reading through things, and one of the things he had said in one of his very rare public speaking engagements was that for him, the more monumental event was the actual landing of the lunar module. He said, you know, stepping a foot on the moon, I'm paraphrasing here, was, you know, basically climbing down a ladder, you know, piloting the Lemon with all the difficulties and dangers that it had, that the landing had. He said that was the bigger challenge and the greater feat.
Right, we've all played those old crappy lunar lander games where you had to get it just right or you'd just explode.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting you say about that. I will recommend two books here, and the first one is one called A Man on the Moon by Andrew Chaikin. And one of the things it Chaikin recounts is that Armstrong in the simulators was in essence doing that. He'd push everything to the limits and 9 out of 10 times would crash the LEM, and to the point that apparently Aldrin got kind of frustrated with it and sort of said, Neil, what's the deal? What's going on? And he Neil said, I'd rather crash here in Houston than on the Sea of Tranquility. But that was a testament to the kind of pilot he was and the engineer that he was. You know, he describes himself as a sort of a nerdy White Sox pocket protector type, and extremely humble. I mean, it's you know, he never used his status as first man on the moon to aggrandize himself.
Right. He shunned publicity afterwards.
Yeah.
It was pretty easy for him, of all people, to probably turn that into a cash cow. First man.
Yeah.
Who's going to top that?
Right. Exactly.
Right. 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 Which also, but I mean, that's the thing of it is after you've done something like that, what else do you do?
Yeah. What's next?
Right. Which I, you know, from what I understand of the kind of person he was, he just went on and did the next thing. You know, he didn't dwell on it. And, you know, I'm sure it was something that, you know, he was a professor of aerospace engineering or some kind of an engineering course in University of Cincinnati. I mean, can you imagine, you know, you get your coursework and you show up and the professor is Neil right. Armstrong?
Exactly. Yeah.
You know?
I'm turning in homework. Sorry, I was busy. Yeah, I was on the moon.
I was on the moon with Steve.
Right, right. So, you know, I mean, it's you know, it's easy to also be sad that that event is, you know, 40, 50 years in the past, nearly. But I, you know, I don't know that we can dwell too much on that at this point. I think what the thing to do is, you know, I think about what I read the brief press release that his family had released a statement. And one of the things that they said in there is you want to honor Neil's memory, and that's to live a life of achievement and humility. And there was a third word and I forgot. But basically it's just, you know, just go out and live life and do things and be modest about it. And when you look up at the moon, give it a wink.
Yeah, which is That's the words of the Armstrong family there. Yeah. The next time you walk outside on a clear night and see the moon smiling down at you, think of Neil Armstrong and give him a wink.
There yeah, the moon is pretty big right now, too.
Yes, yes. Getting close to a full. So, anyways.
And so, hey, it's amazing to think, though, how short amount of time it went from the Wright brothers to Neil Armstrong being on the moon. That's historically, that's a blink.
Oh, it's a, yes. Yes, Neil, he soloed as a pilot around his 16th birthday. So we're talking late 30s, late 1930s or so, maybe early 1940s. He didn't fly in World War II. He flew in Korea.
It says in the mid-1950s, he interrupted his college studies at Purdue University, become a Navy fighter pilot who flew 78 combat missions in the Korean War.
Right. And then went on to be a test pilot in the X-15 program.
Right, and the test pilots, oh my gosh.
Yeah. Right, and he Not joined the Astronaut survived. Corps in 62.
Right, right. So, you know, an amazing life of achievement. And again, done very quietly and without a lot of fanfare.
And so he stopped the silence using that too. That was pretty cool.
Yes.
Now the other sad news, a little more down to earth. Comic book artist great Joe Kubert also has passed away. He died before Neil Armstrong had passed away. Joe Kubert, of course, most recently was working with his son Andy on the art for Joe Straczynski's Night Owl Before Watchmen series. And I'm sure they've got another artist lined up. I just don't know who that is. I remember Joe Kubert from my childhood more for his Sergeant Rock comics. I was never a big superhero comic reader as a kid, but man, I ate up those war books. And Sergeant Rock was hard hitting, two fisted action.
No doubt about that.
Yeah. He died on August 12th.
Thank you. Thank you. Anyways, go Google examples of Joe's work, and he did more than just the war comics. He also did
Tarzan, right? And he supervised the production of Sergeant Rock and Weird Worlds there.
He also did I've seen him have some art of Superman that he's done. Now, I don't know if he did any stint on any Superman books or not. But his style is very distinctive. And you just know, it's like, wow, that's like Sergeant Rock is Superman. You
know? His first work for DC was Seven Soldiers of Victory, and he was also a long time associated with Hawkman.
There you go. There you go. So, anyways, and he established the Joe Kubert School for illustrators and comic book artists.
If you read comics, you probably have seen almost all of his graduating class. It is a ridiculous amount of people who graduated, including his two sons. It's right. Ridiculous.
Right. See, I mean, yeah. said some of his students include Rick Veitch, Eric Schanhauer, Steve Lieber, Amanda Connor, or some of them they mentioned.
And Amanda Connor is also doing work on Before Watchmen. She's drawing the Silk Spectre book.
When I understand, it's probably the other readable book in that series.
It's my favorite of what I've read so far, actually. And not only the story, but Amanda's art is, I think, really. It's got just the right zeitgeist for what that story is. I haven't read all of the Before Watchmen. I've liked the Minuteman book so far that Darwin Cook's doing, and Silk Spectre. The Ozymandias one is it's so-so, and I've only read the first issue of Night Owl, and I haven't read the Comedian or the Dr. Manhattan books yet, so I can't speak to them. It's not that awful. I don't think it's that bad.
I heard as one of the comics, like the villain Molar is going to be like one of those things. I think that's basically as close to basically getting bottom of the barrel as you can get with this.
Yeah, I haven't read any of them yet. I'm waiting for a couple more issues to pile up. But
I get a feeling it's going to be one of those books that people just get into trades, and then you're going to see the real feedback on that.
Well, that makes sense. Yeah. And when you could sit down and see it all at one fell swoop. All right, well, anything else that you gentlemen want to contribute and want to say about Neil Armstrong or Joe Kubert?
Nope.
No, not really. That they both are probably in their field the most influential people that you're ever going to meet. I mean, Neil Armstrong inspired many people to be in NASA, and Joe basically trained generations of comic book artists and even writers.
Yeah, exactly. Their influence will be felt for generations to come, and they will be missed. All right, guys, I'd say let's go ahead and take a break. And then when we come back from that, we are going to do some deep geeking on the Centauri Prime trilogy.
Not sure what to have for dinner tonight? Well, here's something to think about. PsyCorp Pizza. Dinner is just a thought away with PsyCorp Pizza.
The core is mother.
All of our telepaths at PsyCorp Pizza are P11s or higher.
The core is father.
To ensure that your pizza is accurate and exactly the way you want it.
You know, honey, I'm thinking pizza sounds...
Oh! Oh.
Trust the core. When you want dinner fast, think of PsyCorp Pizza.
And welcome back. We are here to do some deep geeking, Joe and Neil and I, on the first of the trilogies, The Legions of Fire. This is the three books, The Long Night of Centauri Prime, Armies of Light and Dark, and Out of the Darkness. These are the Centauri Prime trilogy, written by Peter David, and these give us the story of Londo's fate and how ultimately Veer sort of comes to power, although that's really at the very end. It covers in essence, the time period between objects at rest, where we see Emperor Molari give the urn with the keeper inside to Sheridan and Delenn to give to David when he comes of age, all the way through and just past the events that we've seen in War Without End, where we see Londo and Jakar at each other's throats. So it fills in those gaps. What happened there? Why is it that when Londo pulls back the curtain and says to Sheridan, look what you have done, what you've left behind, and the capital city is all in flames? And so, having said all that, Joe, Neil, do you want to kind of give a quick synopsis? I'll tell you what, Joe, why don't you give us a quick synopsis of Legions of Fire, The Long Night of Centauri Prime, the first book. Can you do that in 2 minutes?
Yeah, I'll give a quick. Basically, all of our characters are pretty much stuck in neutral. And I apologize if I'm going to butcher these names. Basically, Londo is stuck on the throne. And how they open the book up is really interesting by the point of view of Londo's keeper. And that really kind of sets the mood that basically this is going to be a little bit different than what we're used to. But as I said before, everyone's kind of stuck in neutral. If you're stuck on Babylon 5 with nobody wanting to do anything, Londo's stuck on the throne. And he decides to get up and basically take a walk around to see the devastation, where he runs into Rifa's daughter, Senna. Like, again, I apologize for butchering these names, who throws a rock at him. Not the smartest thing to do. And basically reams him out for everything that he's done. And Londo kind of just basically takes it and offers her a position in the royal court, or at least to be kind of his assistant. She refuses, much to the chagrin of the family that's housing her, and she later comes back and decides to join him. And Sienna is also another character kind of stuck in neutral. She basically is stuck with these people because of what Londo did to Rifa, that she has really no house, and with the devastation of Centauri Prime, really nobody wants to deal with kind of a person that's no longer in favor with the Emperor. Same with Lady Morella, who's going to be a major factor in this series, is that she's stuck basically being out of favor with the Emperor and nobody wants to deal with her.
Ariel, also, not Morella.
Ariel, yes, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And another character we meet is Dorella. Again, sorry for butchering the name. And he's the head of the Royal Centauri Guard. And we find out that he's in love with Londo's ex, one of many, and he's basically stuck in the position till the Drop take an interest in him, and then kind of move him into a lot more powerful. He ended up gaining power throughout this, but to start book, basically everyone's in neutral, and nobody seems to be moving. I mean, that's kind of the one complaint you can make about the book, but then it kicks up a gear, where we see kind of this post-World War II Centauri Prime, where all the Centauri are just basically resentful to the ISA, and that kind of leads into book one, which is kind of Londo having to play this act of, you know, having to deal with, you know, the Centauri people, Veer, Timov, Senna, the Drock, and everything else. And basically book one is basically setting everything up later. The other big revelation we find in book one is that the Technomages have again taken an interest in the Drock, and one of the Technomages that appears to Veer is called Kane, and he plays a very large part in everything, to the point that he convinces Veer to basically say the name of the Drock that's basically has the keeper on Londo, and that leads to Veer's imprisonment, and everything kind of goes bad from that point on. I hope that's as brief as a summation as I can get on book one, because there is a lot that happens in
the right
book.
And of course there's the ex-wives in the book as well.
Yeah.
Right. Timov returns to the palace. Marielle, as you said, Joe, is on Babylon 5. The Technomages make an appearance. Durla, who is the captain of the guard, and he, of course, not only is he ambitious? He also has a sort of a grudge against Mallari, a grudge against a lot of people. He's sort of a conniving type.
He actually reminds me of Londo when we kind of first meet him.
Right, right. And that point is made in later books as well. Veer makes that comment as well. The second book, Armies of Light and Dark, delves a little bit more into what Durla is doing behind the scenes as he maneuvers his way into Londo's court and through the Drak. Now, he doesn't have a keeper, but the Drak like him because in the same ways that the Shadows liked Londo early on, he's ambitious and patriotic and has certain sense of grandeur and a vision that's easy to manipulate. So they don't need to put a keeper on him, but they are sort of manipulating him through his dreams, and he does have a thing for Mariel. Now, Veer has in a bit of weakness had a technomage cast a spell on Mariel to make her love him unconditionally. Veer uses this to get her to become a spy in Durla's circles so that, you know, Veer, as he realizes there's something going on, but isn't quite sure what it is. The technomages let him know that it's the Drak. Durla establishes the Prime Candidates, which is basically a Hitler youth group.
Pretty much.
And these are, you know, the best and brightest and basically most impressionable young Centauri males, all about Centauri Prime. Through the subconscious manipulation with the Drak, Durla starts sending out various groups of Prime candidates to excavate sites on outlying worlds, which turn out to be old Shadow strongholds, and start digging up old Shadow technology, including a death cloud. Fortunately, with the aids of the technomages, Kane and two adepts named Gwen, and I can't remember the other one.
No one does.
What? Thank you. They are able to thwart the efforts to activate the death cloud, but Kane dies in the process. Meanwhile, Sheridan and Delenn start to become curious and concerned about what's happening on Centauri Prime. They enlist Private Citizen Michael Garibaldi and Lou Welsh to do some investigation along with Citizen Jakar. And, of course, they're finding out that, you know, the Drak are moving. Meanwhile, through all it all, you know, Londo is doing his best to try to get messages to Veer that isn't necessarily tipping off the Drak that he's fighting the Keeper. Veer starts to build an underground, his Army of Light, in the wake of the successful destruction of the Death Cloud. He also kills one of the main members of the Prime Candidate with a bomb he plants on his person, who is also responsible for killing Lou Welsh. And that's really with pieces in place. Veer starting to make his counter move. That leads us to Out of the Darkness. So, Neil, do you want to tackle that synopsis real quick?
No, you should probably do that. Or
All right, well, I'll do that, Joe, although everybody chime in as you see fit. David Sheridan comes of age. The keeper who has been sort of the little keeper that's in the base of the urn has been sending out telepathic signals over time to bind with David. And, of course, when David sort of under the influence of this opens it up and the keeper attaches it to himself, attaches itself to David, he heads for Centauri Prime under the psychic control of the Keeper. Of course, John and Delenn are completely aghast about all this, but they also recognize that they can't risk an interstellar incident. It wouldn't take much to get the Alliance to come pouring in on them, but they don't want that, so they're trying to maneuver around all that, so they get Jakar and Garibaldi to see what they can do about rescuing David. Shakar was wearing a changeling net, and of course, during a riot in which Londo and Durla are, there's an attempt of assassination on Durla, as it turns out. Shakar is discovered, and of course, he's imprisoned. Durla is really making, basically trying to marginalize Londo. And of course, Londo can do nothing because when he tries to take action, the Drak prevent him through the Keeper. Veer is working his, what he can do in the underground. They are going through catacombs all through Centauri Prime. They basically plant bombs on the Tower of Power, which is this giant windowless structure that Durla has built as a monument and a symbol of a resurgent Centauri Prime, which goes hand in hand with the giant fleet that he's been building surreptitiously. Durla manages to piss off the houses of Centauri Prime, but they're kind of powerless to do anything. At the denouement, Durla is ready to unleash the fury of Centauri Prime Reborn. He's about ready to give the go codes when Veer and his band of merry men detonate the bombs that bring down the Tower of Power and break open the top level where all the Drak starts spilling out. And of course, when the people of Centauri Prime see this, they realize that they've been duped, and it hasn't been about Centauri Prime, it's been about manipulation from an alien race. Durla is aghast because that's not what he expected it to be. And of course, Mariel, who, by loyalty to Veer, gets into a fight with Durla. They go out a window and fall to their death. Shakar, of course, now we start overlapping with the incidences of
where that at?
Out End.
Yeah.
Where we see where John and Delenn have been captured, trying to get back to Centauri Prime to save David. There's this the scenes in the Emperor's chambers. Now the fires, as it turns out, the Drak had planted fusion bombs all around Centauri Prime, and when the Tower of Power came down, Shiv Kala, the Drak who is in control of Londo's keepers, detonated the bombs that were in the capital city and on that continent. At that point, Veer dispatches his technomage friends to disarm the rest of them, but that's where all the fire and destruction is that you've seen in War Without End, and of course in the beginning movie. Well, at that point, again, you know, as we know, this is where Shakar is brought. He's actually brought in and hiding through most of this exchange. When he comes out, that's when Londo and he strangle each other. The Keeper comes to life to fight back against Shakar. They manage to capture to get David. They take him back to Minbar. The shuttle, let me take that back. The shuttle that Londo has ready for John and Delenn to leave, as you recall, these are an old retainer of Londo's and a couple other trusted advisors who are taking John and Delenn off the planet. And they also have David sedated so that the Keeper can't have any contact with any other Drak. Now, of course, the only way we find out to get the Keeper off of someone is to kill the Drak that controls it. So,
Mr. Garibaldi.
Shiv Kala is on the outs now with the Drak entire, because the rest of the Drak feel that Shiv Kala did not handle the situation the way that was most appropriate. And so in an attempt at revenge, Shiv Kala shows up in Veer's quarters to exact his revenge, and Veer very calmly says, well, before you do that, can you tell me how to, you know, who controls the Keeper on David Sheridan? And Shiv Kala says, well, that's me. Veer says, thank you. And out from the closet comes Mr. Garibaldi going, what's up, Drak? And he blasts him. The Keeper immediately falls off of David. Everybody's okay. Veer is recognized as Emperor by the Interstellar Alliance. And there you have it.
That's pretty good, to be honest. Yeah, that's pretty good, of about almost 1,000 pages of that we have to go through with this.
Yeah, I mean, we obviously glossed over some details, and I think now is the time to get into that. So let's start. We'll go macro and then end up micro. Joe.
Yes.
Overall, what's your opinion of the Centauri trilogy?
Overall, I really wish that when TNT basically said, "Hey, Joe, what spinoff you want to do?" he came up with this instead of the Ranger show. To me, this is the best book series. This is pretty much the coda for Babylon 5. Everything, I wouldn't say everything is picture perfect, because I also have some complaints that we can probably get into later. But to me, this is as good, and out of all the book series that we're going to discuss, actually feels like Babylon 5. Now, whether it's because of Londo and Veer being the major characters, or we have all the major characters in play, it really does feel like Babylon 5. And it works on so many levels, with Centauri Prime being this kind of post-World War I Germany.
And it could have been, you know, quite well done. I could see it being adapted for TV.
Yeah. Well, the irony is, too, is that what I really like about Babylon 5 and science fiction in general, when it becomes an allegory for something else, and I don't want to get too controversial, but you can make a very good argument that even though it was written a year before, this is a very post 9/11 story. Because a lot of stuff that kind of happened after 9/11 kind of happened to Centauri Prime, with basically this rev up to go to war against the ISA. And to me, I think Peter David, even though personally me and him don't get along, I think this is his best work. And out of every book series that's come out, whether it be Star Trek or Star Wars or numerous other ones, this trilogy to me is the best franchise work ever done. So, putting on the giant and a stool for Tim to knock down. Go ahead.
Well, I was gonna get Neil's take on it next.
Overall, I enjoyed it quite a lot. There are, you know, there were a few things here and there that I did have some complaints about, which we might discuss a little later. But overall, I thought it was a very strong series. And yeah, I mean, I would have loved to have seen the whole thing adapted for TV. You know, what we have is quite strong. And, you know, of course, next best would be a nice audio series adapting. It would be cool.
But that would be pretty neat. All right. Well, for me, I enjoyed it more the second time around, reading through it in preparation for this, than I did the first time. To me, while I think it does a fairly good job of filling in some details, I felt it was the weakest of the three. And some of it has to do with Armies of Light and Dark. I don't buy Veer as the action hero, but we'll get into that a little more here in a minute. I also think Peter David's writing, he has this, let me preface it by saying I've not read everything that Mr. David has written, okay? And I'm strictly judging by what I've read for Babylon 5 and, of course, the two episodes that he scripted and the one for Crusade. I feel that there's this urge to make references that are anachronistic and take me out of the story. With the Centauri trilogy, a lot of it's the names, like the Tower of Power. That's the Earth, Wind, and Fire horn section. There's another character in there. He's like the Minister of Defense, Castig Leone. Castig Leone. Well, there's I knew that sounded familiar, and sure enough, there's an artist named Castig Leone. One of Londo's advisors is an old house retainer named Lord Dunsany. Well, Lord Dunsany was one of the very first modern fantasy writers back at the turn of the 20th century. And there's all they cease to become homage and become these sort of wink, wink, nudge, nudge references. And it just takes me out of the story so much that I get this feeling like Peter David's impressed with how clever he can be.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's Peter David. I mean, I've tried to meet the guy twice, and it doesn't work out well. That's why he's not, like, my favorite person in the world. But it might be just because in my generation, I didn't get a lot of those. I mean, Tower of Power is a stupid name. I'll give you that.
Yeah.
But all the other things, I didn't really pick up on. Maybe it's just because of I just didn't catch them or anything like that. But I think his greatest thing with Peter David is that I think he really nailed the voices of these characters correctly. And while I do agree Veer as the John McClane of the Babylon 5 universe just doesn't work, you almost have to put Veer in that situation to show him grow.
But I disagree. I think the growth is this is now I'm getting all crazy. I think the growth are those things like when he, in essence, assassinates the prime candidate who killed Lou Welch.
Right.
And he plants a bomb on the guy's head.
That's awesome.
But he's got to do it. He knows he's got to do it, and he recognizes. To me, that's the growth. It's it starts where he kills Cartesia, but he does that more out of defense for his friend Londo, or at least he can rationalize it this way. It becomes harder and harder to rationalize those actions for a more abstract concept, for the good of Centauri Prime. Well, what does that mean? Well, everybody's acting in what they think is the good of Centauri Prime.
Right. But I think for him to get to that point, you needed to show him in a more action level. If you would have just basically had him, one, does Lady Morella, I'm going to apologize for screwing up the name. that may be the coldest freaking thing in Babylon 5 I've ever seen him. Entire life, where he has Galen cast love spell number 9 on her, and it is to me that was like ooh, but it was another situation where Veer really doesn't understand the consequences in his actions. When he has to go basically plant a bomb on the back of a guy's head, he understands the consequences for that. But I think you needed an action scene like that, and also when they go to that planet, that's when they kill off Kane, because I mean there's. Book 2, to me, basically, those two deaths of Kane and Lou Welk, I never saw coming. Someone like Lou Welk, if this was a Star Wars universe, he'd have like 4 books to him by now.
Right. You're right. And that was one of those instances where I was really impressed with the storytelling, because that was a risky thing to do. Lou Welch is a likable guy. Yeah, he's a minor character
who was just basically in the first season, but
yeah,
season 2.
Yeah, he straddles the 2 seasons. But you're right. He's Zach Allen. Lou Welch could have been Zach Allen, but they for whatever reason. Went Zach as opposed to Lou, and I don't. That's a whole other tangent, and I don't mind that. I liked seeing Lou again, and you're right. And the other part of it is that he dies so unheroically.
Yeah, and that is actually brilliant in my mind, because I think the problem that sometimes you get with these with kind of like something as big as Babylon 5 is that. Even the smallest little character gets this like huge heroic death. Kane gets kind of the huge heroic death by saving Veer when they're blowing up the Shadow Killer, the Planet Killer. And with Lou, it's just like, oh, there's a Drock. How can you see me? Oh, what's that prime candidate doing? Okay, he's got super strength and now I'm dead. It's just like so out of nowhere. It's like, it actually kind of reinforces what I think is always missing in these kind of franchise book is that people die, and that's the problem with the franchise books is that you know that Kirk and Spock are not going to die. You know that Luke and Han are never going to die, but if you have Wedge die in one of these books, okay, now things get to serious land.
Well, according to Jason Davis, according to Larry DiTilio in Echoes, Welch was replaced by Allen due to issues with the actor who played the former, so maybe the writing was on the wall.
Well, and that's fine, and that's the nature of television.
Right.
The point of the matter is that the Lew Welsh was a very likable character.
Yeah, I mean, he was only there for a little while, and you remember his face. You remember him.
Right, exactly.
He was there, and so I guess supposedly he was promoted to be on the personal guard of Clark, you know, in terms of... Right.
Which is another thing that you could have taken and made that a series in itself.
Right.
Like, what didn't he see?
Right. Right. So that was I like that. And I'll tell you the other thing that of the characters I really loved is I loved seeing Timov again.
Yeah.
I liked that the tragedy of that relationship she has with Londo, you know, when it's left off in Soulmates, that he keeps her as his wife because she was the only one that was basically a straight shooter with Londo, and he respected that. There's this brief, almost flowering of the romance where she realizes, you know, maybe there's more to Londo and he's changed. But the tragedy, of course, is he can't let her get close to him because of the Drac.
Right. So he wants to protect her.
And to protect her, he has to hurt her.
Right. There's the tragedy right there. The tragedy.
Exactly.
Well, and I think that's the Drac. I mean, what you can say about them, even though they do come off as the sea level shadows, is that in this series, they use all of Londo's friends as weapons against him. Oh, you want to save the ISA? Well, we'll kill Veer.
Right.
I mean, I thought that was kind of a genius move. I actually thought of all the characters that if you wanted to up the danger, killing Timov would have upped that danger level to 11. Yeah, because you.
Yeah, but see, you didn't. You didn't need to kill her. You've already broken her heart.
But I think with the Drac is that they make these empty promises, like these. They almost become empty threats. Like, oh, we're gonna kill Veer. It's only taken us almost 20 years to do it. Or, you know, we'll kill Timov. Oh, we're not gonna do it. And we'll kill Sienna. Well, we're not gonna do it because you acquiesce to this. I mean. It's kind of a weird game that they're playing, but at some point in time, they just can't be empty threats. They've got to take one of those three characters just out of the game.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because that's one of the things that I caught this time around that I think I missed the first time around, is that Shiv Kala, part of his motivation for what he wants to do is he wants Londo. He doesn't want to just break Londo. He wants to... For lack of a better term, he wants to O'Brienize him. He wants Londo to say, "I love Big Brother," as the bullet enters the base of his brain.
Yeah.
And he fails.
Miserably.
And that's where, you know, why Shiv Kala comes back looking for his vengeance against Veer, is because the rest of the Drac foretell, you know, it's like, no, you gotta break him. Just break him outright. Just put pressure on him. And if he can't handle it, get the next guy in to do our bidding. And Shiv Kala says, no, this is a better way. This is a more appropriate way. And when it fails, Shiv Kala finds himself on the outs and now being exiled, in essence, all he has left is vengeance. And I thought that was an interesting dynamic, because that plays into one of the things I think is a hallmark of Babylon 5, that alien cultures aren't monolithic, that they all, within each given government, race, planetary system, there are factions within that.
Oh, yeah. And I think that's kind of another thing that you're seeing in with even the Centauri, is that, you know, going into these books, it's like, oh, the Centauri hate the ISA, and then you have Veer's Rebel Alliance, for a lack of a better term.
Right.
And basically, you're seeing that Veer is building up people that don't necessarily agree that going to war is the best thing. Now, whether do I really buy that the Centauri would have beaten the ISA? No. But it really does kind of pump up the drama that, like you said, about all these different factions. And, you know, the drama being built that Veer is building this kind of, like, fifth column is... almost the same thing as what Shylock is kind of doing with the Drac. Like, you know, let me do my thing here. I just don't see the Drac giving him that amount of time. That's kind of the problem I have with it. I think that's the problem that a lot of people would have with this book, is that with the entire series going on for almost 20 years, is yeah. that at some point in time, someone ahead of She-Lock is going to be like, listen, dude, go or get off the pot with this.
Right, right. Because really, in the end, the Drak don't necessarily – we know that the Excalibur has found the cure for the Drak plague. Okay, that's over and done with. And while the Drak want their vengeance against Earth and against the Interstellar Alliance, as much as anything, they just want everybody fighting and destroying themselves as basically retribution for their masters, the Shadows, having been driven out of the galaxy as they perceive it. So I'm with you there. To get 20 years to build this up to the point where they might finally strike. And the other part of it, by the flip side of it, is that moment when Veer's commandos blow up the Tower of Power and it's raining Drak, that the population rises up going, hey, we've been duped. And I just found that to be unbelievable that people would turn on a dime like that.
But of course, part of the waiting game was the David Sheridan business. So that was, part of the whole thing of, I guess he's trying to keep things relatively stable in Centauri so that, things will then start happening when David Sheridan's Keeper comes out.
But I never really got the thought yes, that's a major part of their plan, is to basically hurt Sheridan and Delenn. But I just don't see it as something that they would – yes, they did say to Londo in that episode, yeah, we're patient. Well, there's patience and there's, not doing anything.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the one – I would have actually liked to have seen, if you got rid of the planet Shadow Killer thing, I would have liked to have had them talk about skirmishes on the Centauri border. Like actually see the Centauri ships take out a White Star and give you the idea that, oh my god, they might actually do it. The instance that you do see it is when the Centauri basically start driving the Drazi. And basically are like, you didn't see anything on these planets. So it's like, you get the idea like, okay, are they going to attack the ISA from the inside at this point? Then why they need like 400,000 ships?
Yeah. And the other part of that too is once again we get the Centauri beginning to take action against small outlying worlds and tiny insignificant planets that for the majority of the Interstellar Alliance members they have little interest in. And while from a strategic standpoint that might make sense. And one can say, yes, history repeats itself. But from a storytelling point of view, I'm sitting there going, I already saw all this.
Yeah. What they really needed to do, and I think, is basically have them take over a world. Let them take over, the Pakmaraz home planet. Why? I don't know. I'm sure it's a garbage dump.
Let them but it's do the best garbage dump in the entire galaxy.
Pretty much. But the thing is that you also have to believe while the Centauri are doing this, does no one think that the Narn aren't going to be building their own fleet or haven't been building their own fleet with all the ISA tech that they've been getting for the last 20 years? That the Narn haven't been waiting for just to wipe them out finally?
I think the teachings of Jakar probably bore some fruit against the cycle of revenge.
Yeah, and that was one of the things in the Fall of Centauri Prime, that episode. That was that moment of revenge when the fleet opened fire on the defenseless Centauri Prime.
Right.
And over 20 years, yeah, I agree with you, Neil. I think that at that point in time, if they wouldn't be a completely, utterly pacifistic world, at least they would be much more reluctant to enter into a conflict without demonstrable cause.
Yeah, I just disagree. I think the Centauri Narn thing, even though Jakar is supposed to break the cycle, I think if they see the Centauri doing the same thing that led to them getting annihilated, you would have factions in the Narn start going, okay, you know what? We've seen this play before. Let's just get ready like we did before.
Right. And I'm sorry, Joe. Go ahead.
I kind of wonder if Jakar, it wouldn't be a good thing to have him as a divided loyalty. Like, one of the big things and what I loved about this was Jakar is the king's hand for Sheridan. And I thought that was a genius move. I thought, man, there's like another book right there. Just like, how did he go from, you know, traveling with Leda and being this passive, you know, being kind of basically a pacifist to being the guy who does the dirty work for the ISA? What happened there?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's one of my, that never really bought the Centauri could beat the ISA. Considering all we know about the ISA, considering, you know, you still have Sheridan and Delenn there, and Carr and Garibaldi all in big, you know, spots that they can rally the troops at any given moment. And just basically the Drox plan didn't make that much of a sense. But other than that...
Yeah, and to your point, I think that's where I regarding the Centauri expansion and testing their fleet on outlying worlds, I agree with you. Even if Jakar's teachings might have taken root, I would have thought that somebody would have taken a preemptive strike out there to say, hey, wait a minute, no. What else? Anything else anybody has to chime on this? I think we're starting to
Well, there's one thing which hasn't been mentioned, which is in the first book, there were some timeline issues in that... Oh. Comparing the time of in the series with what's in the book. In the book, we have things like 8 months have passed between chapter 3 and chapter 4, and it's not until chapter 12 that Londo leaves for his encounter with Sheridan and Delenn. So that's basically another, you know, it seems that more time has happened between episodes than what we saw on the TV show.
Right.
So, anyway, so this was a discrepancy, and I wrote to Peter David about this, asking him what was going on there, you know, why he had so much time in the books, while, you know, in the show, quite a lot less time happened. And he basically said that in JMS's outline, he had all this stuff going on, and it just wasn't realistic for it to be taking place in the short amount of time in the TV timeline, as opposed to what he put in the book.
That's interesting.
Okay.
So,
I mean, that sounds like author's choice there.
Right. So, I mean, that's just something in the first book that, you know, it is just a note there, of what was going on there in case, you know, people were trying to reconcile things.
All right.
I think, does anyone actually, now my question is this, and maybe somebody can answer that. Is Sienna in the beginning? Is she that girl from in the beginning?
Yes, okay. She is. If reading through it, as Londo gets through, as time goes on and he's writing his memoirs and sort of Dune style, many chapters of the book, of the books open with excerpts from Londo's chronicles, if you will. It's clear that his memory is slipping as he is drinking more alcohol to try to keep his keeper anesthetized, to the point where he's not sure who she is, but thinks it's this person. But from the omniscient point of view of the reader, yes, Senna is the young lady in the beginning with the two children in tow.
Right. Yeah. If you take a, you know, just do a Google under Senna Reefa, you know, you'll see at least on the Babylon5.wikia.com, there's an entry for her, and you can see, you know, it has her picture, from in the beginning there, and a nice biography and then references to, the three books plus in the beginning.
Now, what did everyone think of her character?
What do I think of her character? I thought, I have mixed feelings. I liked the idea that in some ways she was almost Londo's conscience. She was able to say the things that Londo wanted to but couldn't because of the Keeper. And I liked that about her. I didn't mind the Reefa relationship there. I thought that was kind of a nice symmetry. I think, though, that toward the end, where she becomes Londo's or Veer's love interest and ultimately Veer's wife, I think she kind of steers toward that trope of the beautiful young girl who becomes love interest for the hero who has no faith in himself. And that was a cliche, you know, and I think that kind of, in my mind, lessens the impact that her character had early on.
And it doesn't really explain why sleeping in Lightning's like with two women, and none of them look like her.
Right, exactly. I thought about that, too, at the very end of it.
Yeah. Okay, I understand you want to try to line everything up, but what happens is she's, like, not really into him, and he's like, well, forget it. I'm just going to have multiple women, which is, you know.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, there's good to be emperor, and otherwise it's just a slight discontinuity that isn't explained.
Yeah. And that, besides that, and I think, I mean, I liked her character when I went back to reread these a few months ago and we said we were going to do these. I kind of actually felt like her character seemed to kind of disappear at times. Like, all right, she's really important in book one, but then she kind of disappears in two, and then, oh, she's kind of magically back for three. I really, my only problem, I think, with the Centauri trilogy is I wish there was more. Like, I wish there was kind of more explanation to what she was doing. Maybe establish more scenes with her and Veer instead of like, oh, she sees something in him that no one else does. Okay. All right, that's random.
Yeah.
So, and by the way, I guess I was looking on the moderated news group for some posts around the time, and most of the posts that I could see there was quite favorable for the series when it came out.
Like I said before, I think out of all three of these, this is probably the most out of the most coherent, because I think with the Psycor book, some in the Technomages book to get into. My problem with the Technomages book is I don't think there should have been a third Technomage book, and part two of the Psycor trilogy is kind of pointless. It's like, okay, here's what Bester has been doing. I just don't care. Like,
well, see, that's where I disagree. I thought the Technomage one. Well, first of all, in a broad strokes, the Technomage trilogy made me like the Technomages, and I thought that Covellis did a good job of weaving in some stuff that had been established and giving a completely different spin and look on it. And that's why I don't have any problem with any of that. The Psycor trilogy, to me, I like it because it is so broad reaching. The first book is the establishment of the Psycor and the beginnings of the Telepath Underground. I like the second one because it was the origin of Alfred Bester, which...
Yeah, I mean, it humanized him some more.
Yeah, but not so much that it made me that it made him sympathetic. Right, exactly. That was a very, very fine line to walk, and I thought it did a very good job of saying, I get where he comes from, but he's still a reprehensible individual.
Yeah.
And then of course the third one, I thought it was just a great denouement end for all that. So for me, I just feel like ultimately, while I thought there's a lot of really great strong things throughout the Centauri trilogy, for me as a whole, it never really comes together. I think it's, I don't know. It just doesn't feel as original a story as the other trilogies are. And whether that's because some of it is based on events that we've seen in prior episodes, that's part of. But again, I think that whole second book, Armies of Light and Dark, other than some of the good stuff we talked about, so I just didn't buy Veer as an action hero. So for me, that whole book was just really that whole section of the story was just off key.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree with you with Veer being the action hero. Your point about the Technomages and the Technomage trilogy, I actually like the Technomages more in the Centauri trilogy. I just could not stand the Technomages in the Technomage trilogy. It got to the point where I was just like, okay, I used to like the Technomages. I love Galen, but you're really making them almost impossible to like. And my problem with the Technomage trilogy in the third book is, here's the third book, and all it is the nitpicking that everyone did for Zaha Doom. Like, why wasn't the eye there? Like, why did Morden live? It's like, not even like a real good end to that series. It's just, here's book three, even though we probably should have made it, ended Galen in book two, and just did the end of Crusade in book three. And that's kind of how I feel about Psycor War, the Psycor trilogy, is that they had an opportunity to show us, I mean, they did tell us kind of what happens in the Psycor War in book three, but to me, book three is just Bester's Mein Kampf. Like, oh, here's all my problems. And like you said, book two, it doesn't humanize him, but I think my problem with book three is it tries everything in their power to humanize him, and I'm still rooting for Garibaldi at the end of the day just to put one in him. Like, okay, I understand what you're trying to do, but I've seen what this guy's done. Someone just take him out already.
I will save my comments on that when we get to deep geeking on it. But
yeah, but I would definitely say that the first book in the Psycor trilogy, out of all the books that they made, that may be the best one. That they took such a chance with basically giving you characters, and I think that opened that book up to be a whole new thing. Like, we didn't know who these characters were, so it didn't matter if they lived or died.
Right.
And just, you know, the idea of the first human seeing, you know, the first Centauri, that was just, like, huge. And I have to say that out of all of them, as much as I love the trilogy, that may be the single best book in the entire.
Yeah, because it took the biggest chances. Yeah,
yeah.
I agree. Yeah. All right, guys, any last thoughts on the Centauri Prime trilogy before we head for break?
Nope, I think that's to summarize most of it.
Yeah, okay. I absolutely love this series. I understand everyone, the problems with it, and I have problems myself, but I think your David Captain voice is so well that it just overcomes everything. And kind of being ignorant to all the problems that you had with it, Tim, kind of helped too.
Of course, Peter David is part Centauri.
I think Peter David is part of a lot of things. I just can't say it on air.
Yeah, but which part of Centauri is he? Which part is... Anyways. All right, well, let's go ahead and take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
Hi, this is Kevin Batchelder. And this is the Saturday B Movie Reel.
Newsom, shoot it! Shoot it!
That's about describes it, yeah.
All right, everybody stay here.
We look specifically at the Sci-Fi Channel's original movies. You know the ones. The ones that air on Saturday night.
Be known throughout the ages as an instant classic.
We need a bigger gator!
Limb cutting, yes. And blood squirting from...
Flying limbs, I called it in my notes.
What could go wrong?
We look on a regular basis at the movies as they come out, and since there have been over 200 of them, we do go back and look at many of them that are now out on DVD. By this point, I had completely forgotten any semblance of seeing if this actually makes any sense from a plot point of view. So come on by, get involved, and have some fun.
Check us out at SaturdayBMovieReel.com.
Our future depends on it. Make it safe.
Okay, and we're back to kind of wrap this up. I just wanted to share a quick email here. This comes to us from Mark Barnhill, and he's talking about a few shows back where we made a reference to a UFO episode. So he says, just FYI, the UFO episode where things suddenly might really be a television show or film isn't a particularly, quote, early example of meta, end quote, on television. The Twilight Zone featured the exact same concept in an episode from 1960 entitled A World of Difference. Says, I love the podcast. Well, as time goes on, I begin to realize I think Twilight Zone did everything first.
Yeah, Twilight Zone is basically the foundation of science fiction on television. Everything they've done.
Yeah,
it's like kind of Simpsons did it for, for sci-fi.
Rod Sterling is basically the atom of science fiction on television. You're never going to top the Twilight Zone. And you can go back and watch episodes and be like, wait a minute, that I remember seeing that as something else. He was just a man.
Yeah. And never mind all the various actors who appeared on that show that went on to become famous in their later careers. Oh, a guy named Robert Redford was on an episode.
Shatner, Nimoy,
right.
Speaking of TV, JMS posted something from Variety on Saturday. I don't know if you saw that.
Nope.
That ABC has inked a deal with indie production company Georgeville TV and Overbrook Entertainment for a pandemic thriller project from Babylon 5 creator J. Michael Straczynski.
It's going to be Jeremiah again?
So it's designed to secure a straight-to-series order, meaning that if ABC likes the script, it will forego a pilot in order in favor of a multiple-episode order. And details of the project are sketchy, but it's described as a blend of procedural and serialized elements. James Lasseter and Jada Pinkett Smith are executive producing for Overbrook with Straczynski. So it's just pandemic is the only plot type thing, but it's in development, so who knows.
I wish you would just go up to DC's office, basically talk to Warner Brothers through them and be like, listen, I want some graphic novels for Babylon 5 or something. Getting before Watchmen, and he is taking a very large risk before Watchmen. I mean, he's not like the most well-loved guy in comics, but he's taking a giant risk. And he's making them buku bucks with the Superman Earth 1. You think he has enough to walk into that room and be like, Psycore War, 120-page graphic novel, we're going to do it.
Right, and I have complete editorial control. Nobody gets to say anything about it,
yeah. Well, of course, we don't know whether he really wants to do that, though.
I know he wants to try to do Psycore War as a TV show, but he's got to give that up.
Well, you know what? Maybe he can just talk him into the rights.
He's never going to get the rights. I mean, I'm friends with people who tried to get the Babylon 5 CCG rights, and that was a complete disaster. Warner Brothers kept coming at them with, like, different numbers every day on trying to get the rights for Babylon 5 CCG. And it turned from, like, a $25,000 thing to a
$250,000
thing. The rights for Babylon 5. You're never going to get those. No one's ever going to get those. Warner Brothers is going to keep them hidden like the Ark of the Covenant. And then one day, now that basically Harry Potter's over and they completely destroy all the good DC heroes, they'll be like, what's the last thing that we have in the back of the corner? Oh, Babylon 5. Let's open it up. And they'll find a way to probably ruin that.
At least you're optimistic.
I have no faith, man. Like, I mean, I have faith in Christopher Nolan after Dark Knight, and even Superman, but I have no faith in Warner Brothers. Babylon 5, the Matrix sequels, no. I have no faith in this company whatsoever.
Yeah. Well. All right. Anything else anybody want to add to any of the discussions? Because otherwise we'll get out of here.
A shout out to Venture Games in Dixon City. They actually had a Babylon 5 CCG tournament in April, and hopefully they're going to be fun in the fall that I attended. So I want to thank all the guys out there, and hopefully there is a Babylon 5 CCG Facebook page that I post, and a number of those guys post at. So hopefully we'll see something come up in the next few months.
Cool. Yeah. Very cool. Yep, and one last thing. Dragon Con happens this coming weekend. If you're hearing the show live, you've got enough time to saddle up and get out there. If you're hearing this because Summer has done her usual job of editing this mess together, then it's too late. You lose. So sorry. Otherwise, you can razz us at BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. That's the email address. There are forums and stuff, and I don't know what those are because, you know, that's not my job to know those things. Summer knows those things because she's so smart. But I can tell you what the voicemail line is because I'm this smart. Voicemail is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year Centauri Prime fell.
There we go. Thank you. Way to step up, Neil. Appreciate that. And we'll see you guys on the other side of the novelizations.
Can't wait.
Great. Right.